Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. Commentators Robert Fox and John Everard will be joining me today to give us their views on the top stories of the day.
If there continue to be these broad swaths of non-compliance, then there would be inevitably further consequences that will place added strain on Russia's already troubled economy.
US Secretary of State John Kerry has met his Russian counterpart in Geneva, and discussions are described as frank yet hopeful. Also, tens of thousands of people marched through central Moscow yesterday in honor of the murdered opposition leader Boris Nemtsov. So is Nemtsov more dangerous to President Putin, dead than alive? We'll also be looking at the new Indian budget. Expectations are high, at least in the Indian parliament.
The credibility of the Indian economy has been re-established. The world is predicting that it is India's chance to fly.
Well, that's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. And yes, welcome to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.01. It's 13.01 in New York. And I'm joined in the studio today by John Everard and Robert Fox. But first, let's look at the day's headlines. Iraq has started a major offensive to recapture the key city of Tikrit from the Islamic State militants. If successful, it's seen as a precursor to an attempt to retake the larger prize of Mosul. Australia's Deputy Prime Minister has said that the search for the missing flight MH370 may soon be called off. And US Secretary of State John Kerry has met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Geneva. Kerry says he warned Russia that it faces further sanctions if conditions of the ceasefire were not met in full. But he also called on Kiev to distance itself from extremist elements fighting in the east of the country. And the UN Human Rights Office has estimated today that the number of people killed in eastern Ukraine has now risen to 6,000. Well, those are the main stories making the news today. But now I'm joined with their take on the news by John Everard, the UK's former ambassador to Uruguay, Belarus and North Korea, to name but a few places, and Robert Fox, the defence editor of the Evening Standard newspaper here in London. Welcome, gentlemen, to the show. Nice to see you both as usual. And now let's start with a story that's been dominating front pages around the world. Yesterday, tens of thousands of people marched through central Moscow in honour of the opposition politician Boris Nemtsov, who was shot dead just metres from the Kremlin on Friday. John, you know, lots of discussion about the fallout from this. Could this potentially be a turning point for Russian politics?
I think it's possible that it might be. I think that Putin, if he did order this killing, and of course everybody has a different theory about this, has scored a massive own goal. The killing goes ahead. Putin has to condemn it. And if you condemn a killing, you cannot then ban a march to mourn the victim. So tens of thousands, some say 50,000. I've seen estimates as high as 70,000 people on the streets of Moscow, almost all hostile to the government. And as Russian opposition figures have been saying on the media during the day, this is typically what precedes the fall of dictatorships. I think Nemtsov may actually prove more dangerous to Putin dead than alive.
Robert, do you think that's true? We see it. Maybe if there's even 70,000 people marching, I see some figures as low as 20,000 today. But the fact is, Putin is just so skilled at playing the nationalist card that if you're seen as, you know, believing, you know, Nemtsov was killed by himself or by another Russian, you're seen as a traitor. He's already kind of saying it's the work of outside agitators.
I disagree with you. Putin, if he's behind this, has blundered. As John was saying, in mafia killings, you isolate the zone, you isolate the victim, and you put distance. This is right by the Kremlin. This is just the day before a march. If it's a terrible blow to Putin. Look at the universal coverage, not only in Western media, but across global media. And the words of Nemtsov live on. I agree with John. I get the sensation that Putin is in real trouble. Putin probably isn't directing the action in eastern Ukraine. There is very strong evidence, and from NATO analysis that I've looked at, that it's the Russian army that's directing this. It's the Russian army that has command and control because it's been given a task to complete to secure this eastern area so that you have a bridge, for example, to Crimea, which means they have to get the port of Mariupol or anyway, a land bridge around the Sea of Azov. This is not in Putin's gift anymore. And I think that something reading between the lines as to what the foreign minister, Lavrov, as you've reported, has been saying to John Kerry today in Geneva, they are very worried about this indeed, because it's the thing that Putin always must fear, and actually Nemtsov understood this too, is that he is in danger of being outflanked to the right. It's a very, very dangerous moment. And that's why I think... probably the West is misspeaking to talk about yet more sanctions again at this moment. Actually, they've got to make sure that somehow the situation in Eastern Europe, which not only embraces Ukraine, but now the Baltics, doesn't carbonize, just completely fragment, so that you get elements fighting, as we have seen a bit of it already, and nobody is really in control.
John, so all well and good, but even if we see some threat to Mr. Putin, it sounds from what Robert is saying, is there it could be an even kind of worse scenario waiting in the wings, you know, a group of military leaders who are hell-bent on kind of taking back Russian territory. Do you think actually we should be a little bit cautious before we kind of encourage too much of a push against Mr. Putin?
There was a wonderful quotation from a senior opposition figure in Russia yesterday. He said, "You only hate Vladimir Vladimirovich if you haven't seen the others." And I think there's probably quite a lot of truth behind that. Putin may be the least bad of a particularly unappetizing selection. That's not a reason for not putting pressure on him to desist from some of his more objectionable actions.
But when you look at the outside world, not just in the sense of sanctions, you wouldn't want to be really investing in Russia at this time if you felt, as a business leader, as anybody who kind of stood up to any kind of criticism of the Russian government, you could be shot on the street. We've seen this for business, Russian business leaders, for Russian politicians. There's a sense that Russia is kind of folding in on itself in a really unusual, kind of difficult way, don't you think?
It doesn't exactly encourage business confidence, does it?
No.
I say that with a slight giggle in my voice, but it really is. And in fact, you're right. We're seeing this. We're seeing a lot of foreign business, a lot of foreign business personnel pulling out of Moscow at the moment because it is just too anarchic. I'd just like to draw your attention to, I thought, a very interesting thing, interesting thought put forward by The Economist in its leader, which has come out since the murder of Mr. Nemtsov, quoting Dostoevsky and I can't remember whether it is The Devils or Lower Depths. And they talk about one layer of terror, one generation of terror after another. That actually isn't what is happening. It is not Dostoevsky's Tsarist Russia, where the apparat, this is the great Pipes thesis, as you know, the apparatus of the terror state and of the police state was so strong as it was in much of the Soviet era. That really isn't happening now. It's, as I said before, it is this real sense of the Wild West, of anarchy being adrift. And that's where John's point about, you think he's pretty bad until you've seen the others. And it is a very worrying moment. And that's why this cannot be diplomacy by headline at this moment. You know, the Mail Online, the Fox News approach. It is not Manichaean. It is not black and white. Somehow, it is in the interest of everybody to steady the ship in Russia and in Eastern Europe, because the capacity for accident, this is the problem of so much military activity that we're seeing at the moment, the submarines, the long-range bombers, looking at obvious targets, the exercises, the rearmament program of Russia, which, again, is another symptom, I suspect, that Putin himself is not quite in charge. This enormous build-up of munitions and materiel, outstripping the West in many, many crucial areas. So this is a time for cool heads, cool diplomacy, and I hate to say it, as a newsman of 48 years, a hell of a lot of it must be done behind closed doors.
John, we should at this point bring in the conversations which have been happening today between the US Secretary of State John Kerry. He's been meeting his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov in Geneva. And the meeting came less than a week after Kerry had accused the Kremlin of lying about its involvement in the conflict in eastern Ukraine. The discussions have been described as, I think, brutally kind of frank. And that kind of the terms used, we know they've probably been shouting at each other almost. But in the end, there's some belief that they both are investing still some more time in the idea that there could be a successful ceasefire.
Yes, I think both of them, for different reasons, hope that the ceasefire is successful. Well, I don't know whether described as frank. They're described as frank by John Kerry himself, and it's not a word he uses often. I think the best comment on these conversations was the photograph, which tragically we can't show over radio, of the two men trying to shake hands and both of them looking like they really, really didn't want to be there. The conversations were clearly very difficult. There's more of this to come. The Russian press, just half an hour ago, announced that at 2200 hours Moscow time, which is in about 45 minutes, that Putin is going to have a multi-way teleconference with François Hollande, Merkel and Poroshenko. That could be quite a difficult conversation too.
You were saying, Robert, that you don't quite believe that Putin's in charge of this process. So do you think that that ceasefire on the ground is maybe not even in his gift to give at this time?
That may well be the problem. I don't think it's the rebels. I think that a lot will depend on the withdrawal of heavy weaponry, and I fear that there are those in the Russian command that may not be keen to do it. The other side of it, which has been brought out by some very interesting liberal, by that I mean very middle-of-the-road commentators, and one of the very best was Matthew Paris of the London Times, who went worldwide, about Ukraine Friday, Saturday in the Times. We've got, if it's a client patronage mechanism, which really does seem to be operating here, Poroshenko and his mates are not quite what you would want to be top of the menu if you're doing this. For instance, they've hired Saakashvili from Georgia to advise them at the moment, and you really do not want that kind of element, that provocative element, very well known for his provocative rhetoric, in the mix at the moment. And I think there is a growing feeling among elder statesmen in the West, and truly elder statesmen, is that this whole approach to the East of NATO has been very badly mishandled. And people really, some quite serious people, quite serious military serving, I know, are very worried about this sort of quasi-pledge, and it is only a quasi-pledge, made to both Georgia and Ukraine about NATO membership. And it does look like a horrible diplomatic misstep at the moment.
Well, it is fascinating.
It is a horrible diplomatic misstep. Yeah. And it's, you were talking just now, Robert, about the question marks over just how far Putin's controlling his own military. The same is going on in the West. Remember who made these pledges. This is starting to get outside the control of the cool heads of the top political minds.
What's interesting, we have a story coming up in the next issue of Monocle, which is about the fact that, not just speaking to Saakashvili, they've pulled in some people who are like Georgians in the Georgian government to actually kind of serve in the Ukrainian government as advisors and as in the ministry. So it's fascinating, the merging of these two institutions. John, I want to ask you another question. We saw at the weekend the outcome of the Estonian elections. All seems fine. But, you know the region very well. You've sat in Belarus, another country that's probably a little bit cautious about what Mr. Putin thinks should happen to them. But when you look at the results of the elections, in the end, it wasn't the Russian-backed parties that won. It doesn't look like Russia really meddled that much in the elections. Do you think we should be happy about the results?
Yes, it was an extraordinary result. The dog did not bark. A lot of people have been going around saying that the elections were the obvious point for Putin to intervene, to put pressure on Estonia, to ramp up the power of the centre party, so-called, in Estonia, which is actually the pro-Russian party, the one that most ethnic Russians will vote for. And, of course, an election by its nature provides all kinds of opportunities for destabilisation. Putin did none of this. He conducted military manoeuvres close to the Estonian border, but he stopped them before election day. If you really wanted to put the pressure on, you'd have kept them running right through the voting. That didn't happen. And as you say, the result of the election was that the centre, I think, gained one seat in Parliament, not exactly a blockbusting success. And the overall tendency in Estonian politics was a sharp move towards free markets and towards more right-wing parties. And it looks as if the governing coalition that's seen Estonia through a period of growth and of determined independence for a long time is going to continue with perhaps a slight recasting. So, as I say, the dog didn't bark. And I think this must raise questions over just what Putin's longer-term plan is. Or perhaps there was a longer-term plan to destabilise the Baltics and he's now done a step back from it. It's a fascinating episode.
I think NATO must step back too. Because what does worry me very much, this talk of forward-based rapid reaction corps headquarters and pumping in 5,000 NATO troop rapid reaction force to each one of these six headquarters in six of the frontline states, the three Baltics and Romania, Bulgaria and Poland. And five by six is 30,000. It is nonsense to be talking about this now, and yet they have been talking about it.
But sorry, Robert, nonsense is it's not enough, or they shouldn't be. It's too much, kind of like sticking a stick into the wasp's
nest. It's unrealistic. What would they do? It's a foolish gesture, I think, in terms of diplomacy. But in terms,
to come back to you, should we? You know, you see it as a provocation, but if we don't do anything, then it just kind of leaves this kind of vacuum in which we can see what happened in eastern Ukraine.
I think it's extremely unlikely in the cases of Bulgaria, Romania, Poland, there would be a provocation. And if they do something in the Baltics, I don't think it would be done by hard power. It is an extreme provocation in view of what was had before and is being lost. The Founding Act of 1997, which was a real agreement that has broken down in fact and in faith, and things like the CFE, the Conventional Forces Europe, the Interim Forces Europe treaty, which Putin threw out of the window because it allowed what he thought was undue and intrusive inspection. I really do think there are two sides to this, and I would pray in aid, and I think she did a very, very good performance in London last week, Federica Mogherini, the High Representative for the CFSP, in other words, the Foreign Minister of the European Commission. The Brits rather sneered at her, but she was just so cool, so well-versed and so reasonable about trying to get a reasonable dialogue going here. Because rapidly, they'd be hollowed out forces. In military terms, these things, they are gestural. Factually, it would take about 10 or 15 years to make those rapid reaction forces meaningful in modern terms. And it is a needless provocation, I suspect.
Well, I think guest-wise, we certainly have the big guns here in the studio today. We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, John Everard and Robert Fox. When we return, we'll take a look at the new offensive to reclaim the Iraqi key city of Tikrit.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska's state ferry system afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The Monocle Daily sets the agenda in Asia and considers what's been dominating the day in Europe and North America.
The programme is often co-hosted out of our Toronto and New York bureau and features regular interviews with special guests both there and across the Americas, as well as experts and analysts at our studios in London.
Monocle 24's regular weekly guide to the perfect Friday night in includes some of our favourite cities around the world and features the insights of the people who know those places best, our unrivalled network of correspondents.
Join me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Andrew Muller.
Your regular hosts for the Monocle Daily every weekday at 6 a.m. in Tokyo, 2200 hours in London.
And welcome back to Midori House. The time now in London is 18:19. And still with me is John Everard and Robert Fox. The Iraqi military, backed by some 20,000 voluntary fighters, has started a large-scale offensive to retake the city of Tikrit from the Islamic State. Tikrit, which is about 80 miles north of Baghdad, was captured by Islamic State militants last summer. It lies in a strategically important position, and the current offensive is seen as a major step in the campaign to claim back territory from the militants. Robert, you know, when we saw before the Iraqi army trying to defend positions, it was a bit of a disaster. They kind of put down their guns and ran. This time, do we feel that they're organized in a way, that they're motivated enough, that they, you know, that they have the desire to retake these places?
It's a very different army. And there is a very critical element in this, which it's absolutely counterintuitive in terms of geopolitics, and it could be explosive. A crucial element of this is the Shiite militias. A crucial element, and there's consensus across international media about this, of the Shiite militias, is commanded by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. There's a general there, and he's organizing it. And having seen what we saw in Mosul in June last year, there's something else there, because they are doing coordinated, registered artillery attacks on positions. And that army that we saw in June couldn't do that. It's very interesting. There's a rather a snotty piece in one of the papers from a correspondent out of Cairo saying they're in ill-assorted uniforms. Who cares? They're Shiite militias, and they're very, very well organized. Now, these are militias, and there's a command structure which would be related, of course, to Hezbollah. They are not Hezbollah, but they have the same umbrella relationship. The people who allegedly are the sworn enemies and stalwart allies of our uber enemy, Mr. Bashar al-Assad in Syria. So in one place there are friends, and in another place there are enemies. And there is also a certain amount of coordination just militarily between ground operations and the air attacks. It is a way they intend to take out ISIL on the ground, because they need to take out Tikrit to go up the river valley, to get to Mosul. And this is the beginning of that. But my head is just reeling with what's going on. But I think there's one crucial figure as to why they have to do it now. And it isn't the Iraqi prime minister, although he's been involved in this. It's Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, who is very old, very sick, and he's been dying forever, for 5 years. But he is there, and he's an incredibly important and influential figure. And he has galvanized the militias of the south, obviously has the support of Iran, though Iran has no control over him. That's such as his interesting position as a spiritual leader. And he has galvanized a lot of these forces. We are in a completely new phase now.
But in effect, you're saying that lined up to back the government in Baghdad, we often see the support being now offered by the West. We have the West, Iran, and potentially Hezbollah all on the same side.
Yeah. You won't have Hezbollah troops there. You'll have American SF, though, amongst them. Doing command and control. It is amazing. I hope somebody's writing a blockbuster Clancy or Wilbur Smith novel about this, because it is the most amazing turn-up.
I think John's thinking of doing that now.
Well, yes, yeah. It's the kind of thing, I agree entirely with what Robert said, it's the kind of thing you just couldn't make up. Yeah. General Soleimani from Iran, who's been coordinating this, not long ago was actually defending Baghdad. Now, for those of us who lived through the Iran-Iraq war, this is just bizarre beyond the realms. But quite clearly, what is happening is, as Robert says, we've got a very effectively an Iranian-led defence of Iraqi lands, led by Sistani, who has said that he wants certain things to happen before he dies. And the list was never released in the public domain. I'm pretty sure that Recaptain Tikrit was one of them.
But let's just look at what could unfold then. So they potentially, Robert, from what you're saying, you feel that they've got the gumption to retake Tikrit, for example. But then they have to kind of go up the river valley. That Mosul is the big city that's fallen. Do you feel that we have that kind of momentum now that could see ISIS pushed certainly out of Iraq, certainly probably not out of Syria, but could be pushed back to the Syrian border?
It's the right time of the year to beginning that. Second thing is, don't play toy soldiers too much on this. It's not so much about arms and the force of arms and disciplined force. It's who can take and hold, as ever in this part of the world, but particularly the story with Iraq and to an extent with Afghanistan, what happens afterwards. This is so important. And what they're trying to do, and this is Sistani, Grand Ayatollah, and al-Abadi, the prime minister, they know they've got to buy in as much Sunni support as they possibly can. They are getting it because ISIS has been defeated quite badly in Diyala province because, as with their predecessors, al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, people under this dreadful regime have had an absolutely horrible time, and that's why they quite welcome it at the moment. It's how to capitalise on this that is so interesting. I just like to say a quick word about Sistani, which I didn't realise, and it came out of a very good conference at the Royal Institute of International Affairs a week ago by a regular contributor here, Jane Kinnenmont. Terrific conference. I didn't realise that Sistani in Najaf has set up a college of theological studies which embraces not just Islamic, but multi-faith disciplines. This new politicization, this new political grouping of Shiism, is moving in a different way. It is trying to be universalist. It is trying to be a really important force which can go out and meet the West in the region. Now, think of what Mr. Netanyahu is talking about at this very moment in Congress about the threat from Iran and so on. We are in a potentially seismic shift of diplomatic affairs in the Gulf region.
Gentlemen, I know this is brutal, but I'm going to make my own seismic shift because we have to bring in one more story before the end of the show. And this is the Indian budget. Now, budgets don't normally get people excited. And the new Indian budget, though, is one that John, I know for one, but you think this is the story we could be talking about at the end of the year?
Well, yes. We've been watching over the last few weeks. A seismic shift seems this is the phrase of the programme. In December, while we were all mesmerised with Ukraine, two big things happened. Firstly, China started to defend, not to devalue, its own currency. The capital outflows from China were such that the central bank had to start buying renminbi. Secondly, Indian economic growth overtook China's. The world didn't even blink, but that is one of those crossings of a graph that really changes history. Now, the budget that Finance Minister Jaitley put out over the weekend really reinforces that. It's not the blockbuster, completely wreck everything, change everything budget that some of the pundits, notably the Wall Street Journal, had hoped for. In Indian politics, this simply would not have been possible. It does, however, firstly, establish a social security net for India's poorest, which is decades overdue. It reduces corporation tax from 30 to 25%, and it shifts the taxation structure on the super rich. It also spends a lot of money on vital infrastructure. This is a big change and a big signal of the way that India is catching China up and is positioning itself to be a really big player in the world of the future.
Robert, we've got about 90 seconds left. Now, the important things about these budgets, when countries are growing and they're becoming a bit more kind of free with their money, is what their play on the global stage. Do you think we're going to see India kind of pressing forward, being a bit more of a global player, kind of rubbing up against China, perhaps even?
In and around this budget, the discussion has been absolutely fascinating, as John said, because when Jim O'Neill came up with the BRICS, it was thought that, you know, the really solid one, the big performer, the hare to the tortoise, would be China as opposed to India, because India had two things. It was A, it was terribly corrupt, and B, the shift from country to town was simply too enormous for it to make it. This is the thing that is beginning to show that India has more growth in it, more petrol in the tank, if I can put it like that, than China, because it's got a different demographic balance from China. It does not grow grey before it grows rich, which was the old nostrum about China. It is a very interesting, very exciting moment, and it everybody is holding their breath. And so all the clichés of the BRICS-type editorials are now up for serious seismic re-examination.
See, we proved it. You can make a budget interesting, not a budgie, a budget, that is. Well, there were certainly no hares here today. There were two foxes. There was Mr. Robert Fox and John Everard. And thank you, gentlemen, both for joining us here in the studio. And that's all we have time for on today's New Midori House. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie. It was researched by David Pleasant and Kate Bullivant, and also by Mike Hewin. And our studio manager, well, he was Chris Chilvers. For the next hour, half an hour, actually, Tom Edwards will be keeping you company with Monocle's international playlist. Then at 1900 hours, it's The Culture Show with Mr. Robert Bound. And at 2200 hours, it's The Monocle Daily, today brought to you by Andrew Muller and Georgina Godwin. The show, well, I'll be back at the same time tomorrow, which is 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, from me, Andrew Tuck, is goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.